Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 786. It's the 26th of May, 2017. On the podcast today, I have Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talking about the oil price following the recent OPEC production meeting, and the following stocks: Quartix, that's QTX, Card Factory, ticker there is Card, and Stock Spirits, STCK. Plus, I also have Neil Pearson, director at broker and advisor Hybridon, covering the following stocks. He also talks about the biopharma sector, but in that sector, he covers Amrit Pharma, AMYT, and Sarium, SAR. I also have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the most liked RNSs on the platform in the last 24 hours too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell. It's Russ Mould. You all right, Russ?
Morning, Justin. Very well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right.
Good.
Ahead of us, though, I'm looking at the 3 days off now from the stock market.
Yes. Yes, good. Absolutely. No, always in favour of switching the screen off.
Yeah,
you know, as Warren Buffett once said, if you enjoy switching the screen off on Saturday and Sunday, try it on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday as well, and, you know, to take a long-term approach.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but do you know what? When it comes to Monday, and I'm twitching a bit, thinking, come on, get the markets back up. I often think bank holidays, they're a bit long. It's a long weekend, you know.
You've got the weekend FT to read. It's big and fat. It'll see you through.
Yeah. Okay, that'll have to do, I think, yes. Yeah. All right, so let's look at the macro side of things. What are you looking at this weekend? Anything in particular?
Well, I guess the big story's been oil. The whole market's been agog waiting to find out what was going to come out of the OPEC summit in Vienna, this regular six-month jamboree, which was a little bit unusual this time in that non-OPEC members were also invited to attend, particularly Russia. And it was just interesting to see that OPEC kind of delivered what everybody expected them to deliver, a maintenance of the production cuts that they agreed last November, an extension of the production cuts by 9 months the next sort of February, March. And the oil price got clobbered overnight and actually went down 3 or 4%. And I guess, that's, you know, on Friday morning sitting here, that's obviously having a bit of a knock-on effect on some of the small, mid-cap and large-cap oil companies quoted in the UK. I guess there are probably two reasons why oil has not responded as favourably as I suspect that the Saudis and the Russians and everybody else were hoping for. First, oil had gone below $50 in April, had bobbed up from 48 back to 54 in expectation of this deal. So in that respect, it's a little bit no news. And although some OPEC members, I think notably Kuwait, were actually pushing for either a bigger cut or a longer extension, that didn't happen. So, you know, they've kind of done what everybody expected. So it's in the price, and the market alters have obviously got, okay, fine, let's move on. So lock in some profits. The other one is that, and if you particularly, maybe this is something you can do over the weekend, Justin, because I did it on Wednesday night,
okay.
was go to the U.S. Energy Information Administration's website.
I'm always there.
There you go. And you personally can drill down, if you'll pardon the expression, and get out all of the details of the big seven oil and gas shale fields in America. And you can actually pull down by field the number of active rigs, the number or the amount of barrels produced of oil a day, and the amount of gas produced per day across all of those seven fields. Now, I've done it. I've aggregated the numbers, looked at the trends, and I think what's upsetting, Pete, what's potentially roiling the oil market is if you look, the number of active shale rigs in the US is now up 120% year on year.
Mm-hmm.
Oil production's back to where it was about a year ago. So the initial oil price shakedown definitely had a big impact on the shale drillers, and I think that's partly what the Saudis were hoping it would do. The problem that they've got is that as soon as oil has rebounded, American high yield debt for these oil companies, the yields have come in, they've been able to either refinance the debt or have rights issues through equity. They've refinanced, and as soon as oil sprags back above $50 a barrel, these guys hit the drill button.
Yeah,
so if you look at it, US shale production basically dropped by around 700,000 barrels a day. It's recaptured all of that. and you've got the consultants Wood Mackenzie, who know more about oil, who've forgotten more about oil than I'll ever know, they're forecasting an increase from shale for 2018 of around 950,000 barrels a day. So that's 1.7 million between friends, call it. Yeah. What's the OPEC cut? 1.2 million. What's the non-OPEC cut? 0.6 million. So basically, by the, say, the middle of next year, US shale production, if it sticks to the expected trajectory, is going to more than offset the OPEC production cut. And so I think that is the key issue. OPEC is not as influential as it once was. It's now responsible for, what, 30, 40% of global oil output?
Yeah.
So as a cartel, it's nowhere near as powerful or as effective as it once was. And I think in the end, shale remains the wild card, the swing producer. And if you, when you diligently go through all of those fields over the weekend, Justin, you will see that there's a very, very big ramp up. And, you know, it's one of those funny things. You almost think, in a way, yes, lower oil would definitely do them some damage, but you almost want the Saudis almost want the US equity market to correct and you know, not be quite so buoyant, because that will probably have just as much of an influence on the oil price as their own policy actions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you know what? I was going to do that. I was going to drag those figures into my spreadsheet over the weekend.
Yeah,
but now that you've done it, though, I trust your research better.
I'll send you it.
But also, so it's a case, really, of letting market forces do its work, isn't it?
Hey,
and hopefully that will work it out in the end. Because like you say, as soon as it goes above $50 a barrel, pretty much, the shale producers come online and that, again, floods the market. So let the market forces... when you're only 30-40% of the market, you can't influence it, you know, like you said.
Well, you're spot on, mate. In the end, what's the best cure for low prices? It's low prices, because it cuts production off. What's the best cure for high prices? It's high prices, because what did high prices drive? High prices drove and funded the technological developments that unleashed shale and fracking upon the world. If oil hadn't gone to $130-odd, $150 a barrel, that wouldn't have happened, because it didn't need to happen and it would have been too expensive. So yeah, the free market will decide. And right now, it looks as if $50 to $60 a barrel is the new normal. And frankly, if you're BP or Shell, that's probably just about enough for you to scrape through and keep your dividend ticking over without stressing yourself too much. But clearly, you know, in the end, if you're Saudi Arabia, you know, you're looking really, you know, $80, $90 plus to balance your budget, and so is Russia. The Saudis and the Russians won't want oil going back through the floor again. The Saudis want to float Aramco in 2018 in a deal that could be worth anything up to valuing the company anything up to $1 trillion, if you believe some of the very good articles in the FT on it. And Mr. Putin in Russia, well, he's got a presidential election to fight next year, next March. Now, we all may laugh and think, oh, well, that might not take too much winning, but nevertheless, he will want to see a healthy Russian economy, and that will be largely, certainly to a degree, dependent on the prevailing price of hydrocarbons at the time. And the higher oil is, the bouncier Russian economy is, the less trouble, the less sweat it'll have to break when it comes to getting re-elected in the spring.
Yeah, well, do you know what? That cliche, and there's a book here for you, I think, Russ, because I've often said this, you know, in investing, cliches, they endure because they have a ring of truth to them, don't they?
There's always a grain in them.
Yeah, there's always a grain there, but I mean, almost analysing these cliches and the cure for, you know, low oil prices is low oil prices. And that, there's one of them, you know, and it works out, it rings true. And I think there's a whole heap of these cliched sayings in the finance world that may be worth analysing. And I can see a book in it for you, Russ.
I must admit, when I was at university, I did read Daniel Yergin's very, very good book, The Prize, which was the history of oil. It's a little bit out of date now, but that was a great read. And anybody who's interested in oil can always read Mark Arman's book, The King of Oil, which is about Mark Rich, whose company eventually became Glencore.
Okay.
If anybody's interested in a bit of stock market history, you may remember that Mark Rich was, I think, indicted by the United States of America for sanctions busting, funneling Iranian oil through South Africa. And he was eventually pardoned by William Jefferson Clinton. So he was a fascinating guy. And the origins of his company, based in Switzerland, ultimately became Glencore.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, I'm waiting for The World of Financial Clichés and How True They Are by Russ Mould.
I'll look into that. I'll give it a think. I've got a mate who's actually written a book on football clichés called The Football Lexicon, which you can still find that. And so he's done it. So, and given he works in the financial markets...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you never know.
Okay. Right, let's move on to some stocks. So what are you looking at this week,
so
Russ?
Three for this week. So one new one, and then two that we've looked at before to provide some updates.
Yeah.
So the new one is Quartix, and the updates are on Card Factory and Stock Spirits.
Okay, Quartix. Never heard of them. What do they do?
Well, Quartix, it's one I've had my eye on for a bit. It floated in November 14. It's AIM quoted, based in Cambridge, and it's a telematics black box company. Now, that may make people get a little bit nervous, because it may make them think of Quindale and one or two other recent accidents in that particular area.
Yeah.
But the shares, since its November 2014 flotation, have done very well indeed, and the company even pays a dividend, intriguingly. So yeah, it's a telematics black box provider. It initially started off, I suppose, a little bit similar to Quindale, selling this service to insurance companies.
Yeah.
But that is, as we found out with another company, quite lumpy business. The visibility isn't always great, and so it's slightly switched tack to do deals with fleets and with truck operators, van operators, and so on. It's big in the UK, it's big in France. It looks like it's just broken into the US, which I think is perhaps the next leg of the story, and the one that we need to look at. You look at the 2016 results, fleet subscriptions were up 19%. The US doubled to 6,000. That's out of the 87,000 customers. And so it's just interesting that, you know, you've clearly got a technology that we know insurance companies do like to use, but they're coming at it more from the fleet side of things, and that's health and safety. So there's a regulatory driver here, which is always a great premise for any investment case. And I think what's intriguing is that because of the move into the US, because of this slight shift from insurance to fleets, and the fleet thing is a long-term subscription deals, and people are just expecting the earnings actually might drop a little bit this year. But you know, if the US goes well, then that could prove to be conservative. The company's cash generative. There's a decent increase in the dividend planned, estimated for this year, even if earnings are going to, you know, have a slight stumble. But if earnings momentum proves to continue, then, you know, the chart, funnily enough, has really kind of flatlined for the last 3 or 6 months, if you have a look at it. But I guess because people are looking at the valuation, that's the key with this. It's on 25 to 30 times this year's earnings, and the same for next year, given the flattening off in momentum. But if the US really begins to make progress, that could be the catalyst for the stock and the next leg up for a share that's already done very well since flotation.
Okay, yeah. I was just looking at the last RNS, and the managing director there sold a million shares.
Yeah, that's probably one of the reasons why the shares have gone sideways. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
But the shares are now £4.12. So.
Exactly, you should have held on to them. Exactly. You sold them at £3.16, they've gone up. So
Yeah, well, we don't know what his circumstances are. I mean, directors' deals I always find interesting, but
yeah.
I prefer to see pack movements rather than individuals. That's, I think, when you get... Because if it's an individual, it could be a tax bill, it could be a divorce, it could be a holiday, it could be a holiday home. You know, it could be anything, whereas if there's a shoal of them moving as one in one direction, that's when I tend to get really interested, to really pay attention.
So if you see the CEO and CFO buying some stock, then that's worth looking into.
Or the chairman, a couple of NEDs all piling in, or occasionally all piling out.
Yeah, yeah.
Then take the hint.
Yeah, they're all piling out. I'd follow them. Next one, Card Factory, yeah?
Yeah, obviously a much more prosaic sort of business. Not that there's anything wrong with greeting cards, gift wrap, and presents. We looked at this back in one of the first ones we did, actually, back in the late winter, and you know, the shares have actually gone up by a third since then. So it was probably worth revisiting the stock after their trading statement this week. And a very different profile from Quartix. I mean, the shares actually went up on the back of the fact the company's like-for-likes in Q1 sales came in at the top end of their growth target of 1-3% year on year. So a very different type of company. They also opened up 11 new stores. Their website, which is in a very early stage, but is a priority for Chief Executive Karen Hubbard. That seems to be going in the right direction. No change in earnings forecast for the year, which, let's face it, from any retailer is probably good news right now, given that it is pretty tricky out there.
Yeah.
Cash flow was good. Net debt came down. And boss Karen Hubbard, most importantly of all, reaffirmed plans to pay another special dividend this year. Now, the shares already pay out a 9.7p dividend. That's roughly a 3% yield. The special for the last 2 years has been 15p a share. Add that on top, you've got a 7.5% dividend yield. And I think that's what's been getting the stock all hot and bothered. And clearly that will provide support. You're probably getting to a stage whereby, given the fairly low growth prospects of the company, even a 7.5% yield, you know, once it gets to sort of the 5-6 range, capital gains wise, you're probably getting near top of the shop with the shares on 16 times earnings as well. But for income hunters, with the cash flow good, the balance sheet healthy, and the market overall consolidating, income hunters will continue, I suspect, to cherish it. Capital gain seekers, after a one-third run in 3 months with the valuation getting full, yeah, they might just sit and have a look at it. But income cherishers, I think, will probably hang in there.
Yeah, it certainly rallied from where we last went. Down at 240 last time, now it's at 340. So
yeah, that was a bit of luck, but we'll take that. But I mean, the long-term income case is still there. But yeah, certainly the capital gain, I wouldn't have expected that, to be honest with you. Not so fast, anyway, by any means.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, and the next one, last one, Russ.
So stock spirits, let's finish on a bit of booze. There's a long weekend coming off after all. So a bit of Polish vodka and never did rum and brandy and never did anybody harm. Or, well, only in small doses, probably not too much anyway. Just remember, this has been a tempest-tossed stock since its flotation in 2013 with numerous profit warnings. You've got an activist investor there nibbling away at the management team, trying to get them to move from High Wycombe to Warsaw. Oh, I suppose, you know, to cut costs. The full year numbers in March were okay, and the first quarter trading statement that came out this week, again, okay, which after the company's recent checkered history, an inline trading statement is probably no bad thing. The shares are down 10% since we looked at it in March, so it's reassuring to see that things haven't got any trickier. Overall, Polish market vodka volumes were roughly down 1%. Company reckons it hasn't lost any market share, which makes a nice change after a sort of aggressive pricing policy went wrong. They are under either voluntarily or under pressure from Western Gate, this activist shareholder, cutting out swathes of costs from the head office. They reckon they'll save around €1.5 million a year in 2018. But no sign of the move to Warsaw yet, so they're holding that one off. But nevertheless, it's all very much as you were. Stocks are around 13 times forward earnings with a yield of 4% with 1.9 times cover, so the dividend yield looks okay. If the company can sort of, you know, get the top line going again, it might look cheap, given that, you know, branded goods can have some pricing power. Clearly, they probably overpushed it a little bit in their Eastern European markets, but it's got a good brand position. It's got a 25% market share in a market where I would guess quite a lot of vodka gets drunk. So there is potential there, and deep down, there's still always that scope in the background for things to get active if that investor who's got a 10% stake decides that management aren't going far enough, fast enough.
Yeah, on a very simplistic level, I mean, can you see the Polish as a nation changing their drinking habits overnight?
Not desperately, no. I mean, clearly there's more than one vodka brand out there, and there's some very famous ones, but nevertheless, it's got some strong local ones. I suspect that they probably did overpush it a little bit on the pricing. That they're now responding to that. There's a cost-cutting program going on. And, you know, in the end, this should be a company that generates decent margins, decent cash, and pays a decent dividend yield, if nothing else.
Marvellous. So the STCK ticker.
That's the one. It's a small cap, yeah. FTSE small cap.
Marvellous. Russ, thanks for that. Have a nice bank holiday weekend. And
and you too.
Speak next week.
I look forward to it. Take care now.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Neil Pearson, Director of Broker and Advisor Hybriden. Neil, thanks for coming back on.
No, not at all. Pleasure.
Now, last time we covered cyber defence and a couple of stocks there in that sector, in that area. What are you looking at this time, Neil?
Biotech. Obviously, quite a strange one. Puts it incredibly out of favour right now. I mean, 2015 seems an eternity ago when it was a really booming year for biotech. I mean, we had solid IPOs both sides of the pond. Even early 2016 was still quite bullish. You had Shire taking over Vaxalta, but really since then it's kind of fallen off a cliff. You know, especially this year, there's been very little to no primary in the sector. There's been no real M&A, and the war on drug pricing in the States, surprisingly, Trump seems to be taking that baton from Hillary and the really very poor rhetoric on the sector. And Brexit here last year has caused huge disruption. The UK biotech sector is hugely beneficial for EU grants and funding, and we have the European Medicines Agency, which is in danger of leaving London, which is creating a big cloud over UK's reputation as a biotech hub. And clinical results as well hasn't really blown everyone away. And I think biotech, like most sectors on AIM, sentiment trickles down from the larger guys. So, you know, everyone knows Woodford's Acacia. Last year, their phase three failed in their cat allergy drug was horrendous for the sector. It kind of reinforces that binary element to investing in life sciences. I mean, before the trials, Acacia were 260, 270, then the news came out and now they're hovering just below a pound. So it's has real knock-on effects.
Yeah, well, when you think of the cyclicality of, you know, investing in stocks and shares, then surely now is the time to be looking around this sector, because, like you say, when it's booming, that is not a good time to get in, because, as we all know, you know, like I said, the cyclical nature of the stock markets goes up, comes down, and then almost like private investors sometimes get this you know, the almost the wrong way round. You know, they get the, when a sector becomes hot and it's grabbing all the headlines, people start jumping into that and drives momentum. But then you haven't got a lot of upside there because it's almost in. You know, it's almost done. It's almost when people are not looking at it and the sentiment's really on the floor, like you say. That's when to start doing some research, isn't it? Really.
Mm. No, absolutely. You're spot on. I think in every sector, when there's been a huge sell-off to high heaven, there lies the opportunity. There's a lot of companies out there where there's a huge disconnect between what we see on the screens for the share price and the liquidity and actually what is going on under the bonnet of the company. They are miles apart, and you're right, there lies the opportunity.
Yeah, it's like, do you know, a while back when oil was tanking, is, you know, I mean, and I started to sort of scale into Royal Dutch Shell, and I was a bit early into the party there, but I started scaling around about £22, I think, but I bought all the way down to about £13, and then luckily I was at the start, my scalings were very small, you know, and as it got towards about £15, it was historical lows. I started really piling in then, and I thought, and I was looking at the chart there, it was a couple of good, you know, technical indicators happening, a bit of a turnaround there, and then all of a sudden, I mean, it's, you know, everything started getting bullish then. So it's time to get back into oil, and once the momentum kicks in there, it's always a good thing. So, you know, I think it's not too good, as long as you've done research, it's not such a bad thing being too early to the party, as long as you don't track everything in, you know, it's almost scaling slowly,
absolutely.
And feel the ground, and so I find once you take a position in the stock, you tend to pay more attention, do more research, you know, so it's almost good to take that initial step in, a small step, and then you know, increase maybe. So what are we looking at? Companies-wise, where's the exposure here? What do you think?
Yeah, so there's two companies that we like very much. One of ours we look after ourselves as a corporate broker, and another one that we've been following for a number of years. Two companies, very two topical themes in the sector right now. The first one is rare diseases and orphan drugs. So what I mean by that is these guys are looking at diseases where there's huge unmet medical needs. And so that is very favorable looked upon by the FDA because the approval process is fast-tracked to really ensure that serious conditions are treated as soon as possible. And that's Amryt Pharma. AMYT is the Epic code. They're on AIM.
Yeah.
56 million market cap. They're in a very interesting transition. They're currently making the move from being a biotech play to more of a pharma play. Mm-hmm. So they're actually build their portfolio. Now they're selling various drugs that target rare and orphan diseases. So they have four products in their bag.
Neil, let me intersect there. So when you say from a biotech into a pharma play, some people may know, what's the difference between those two? What's the fundamental difference there?
So biotech are the pure R&D guys. So, you know, the guys that are taking, identifying an early stage molecule, and they're saying, right, okay, we're going to use it for this particular indication of disease. And then they have to take it through phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, perhaps some more follow-on trials from phase 3.
Yeah.
After phase 3, you get FDA approval. And then you can start selling the drug.
Mm-hmm.
So a biopharma company has a very nice balance between the risk-averse biotech side, but they also have the de-risk nature of having a commercial model of actually selling these drugs, and that's where Amryt Pharma are. They're at that inflection point.
Yeah, so it's almost like a resource company having a bit of exploration and a bit of production.
Correct.
As well, kind of thing.
Bottom.
Yeah, that's
the analogy, yeah.
Yeah, cool, go for it then.
So, no, they have one product that's currently selling. They're looking at HOFH, which is a very rare genetic disorder that causes premature cardiovascular disease. I mean, they have a licensing deal for that product. Mm-hmm. Some good royalties. I mean, it's going to net the company about 18% royalty, up to 15 million sales, and then that ratchets further up as revenues grow. So that's the more commercial side, the pharma side of the company. The more biotech side of the company is looking at a condition called epiderm olysis bullosa, EB, or butterfly skin is almost a street name. It's a horrendous disease affecting children. It causes the skin to be incredibly fragile, falls off at a touch, and there's no cure for this at all. The current treatment is just applying numerous dressings on a daily basis. Is incredibly painful for the child, and And now we're currently in phase three with the gel treatment, which I really hope, you know, gets some solid results and that gets on market. And I hope we hope to see an update from that trial later this year. So at 56 million market cap, we think that's very poorly valued right now. And it's certainly got a lot of legs to run there, I think.
Yeah, okay, excellent stuff. So that's AMYT, and we've had the guys on from Amrit a few times, actually.
Yeah.
So what else are you looking at there, Neil?
So we also look after a company called Sarium on AIM, S-A-R.
Yeah.
That's about 23 million market cap. These guys are in another very topical space called autoimmune space. Yep. So these are diseases which occur when body tissue starts to attack its own immune system. Mm-hmm. So these guys are focusing on cancer drug discovery development. So they're biotech, they're more early stage. They look at preclinical, identifying early stage molecules, and then looking to license them out. Now, Sarium are very unique because they're one of the very few early stage biotech companies on AIM that have successfully secured a licensing deal for one of their programs. So yeah, their flagship product, CHK1, which is the name of the drug, looks at various types of cancers from pancreatic, bladder, lung, and prostate. They actually licensed that program to a US company called Sierra Oncology. That was in September last year. So Sarium receives a 27.5% stake of that. They share a payments of $7 million up front, $2 million on the CTA transfer, which happened last year. So they've already received that, which is just shy of $2.5 million. But the real money potential is their share of $320 million in various clinical and regulatory and sales milestones. So very attractive to investors when you're looking at the potential amounts received that could be received by Sarium.
Marvelous stuff. That's SAR Sarium and also AMYT Amrit Pharma. Excellent stuff. Yeah. Neil, thanks for covering that, and hopefully get you on soon to cover another sector. Brilliant stuff, and have a nice bank holiday weekend.
And to you.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They were at five, Petrofac, PFC. At four, Georgian Mining Corporation, that's GEO, ticker G-E-O. At three, reminds me of that song, A-T-I-S-C-O, yeah. Anyway, at three, Andalas Energy and Power, A-D-L. At two, Echo, that's E-C-H-O-D-I-S-C-O. Okay. And at number one, the most followed company on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours was UK Oil and Gas, and we charted that with Nicola earlier on the podcast, so you listen to that. If you subscribe via iTunes or Audioboom, it's probably easier to get it automatically onto your phone, so you can see, listen to that as well. Alright, top 5 most liked RNSs in the last 24 hours were: at 5, late yesterday, Echo Energy, that's completion of debt facility. At 4, Andalas Energy and Power, that's director shareholding. At 3, UK Oil and Gas, just after market close yesterday, operations commences at Broadford Bridge, -1. At 2, Strategic Minerals, SML, final results. And at 1, the most liked RNS was from Anglo-African Oil and Gas, AAOG, update on the first workover at Tilapia Oilfield. But the share price has gone down quite a bit, so I don't think it went to plan, the first one, but apparently the significant one hasn't been worked over yet. Now that's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.